Good afternoon. You are joining the second hour of We the People Radio. First hour, we chatted about worker rights. And Bill's trying to do my job for me.
Oh, yeah, I meant no disrespect.
He's over here giving me smoke signals on what I'm supposed to do next. What the heck? I don't like to do it the same every time. You know that.
Oh, my gosh.
I'd be a terrible factory worker. All the cars would look different.
I meant no disrespect, Louis.
Couldn't have made the Ford Fusions that we all own right now because they would all look different. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Okay, so what I was going to say is in the first hour, we talked about workers' voting rights. So now we're going to do a dramatic shift. However, we're going to go back to the Clarion Project. We had somebody from Clarion Project 2 weeks ago. So these guys have all sorts of interesting topics that they cover, and they have an amazing cast of characters, I guess, as we say. So one of their advisory board members is Rahil Raza. Hopefully I'm saying that correctly. And she is a Clarion Project advisory board member. I'll just read what I have.
A founding member.
I should not ad lib. Yes. No, she's a founding member of the Muslim Reformer Movement and an international human rights advocate. She has an amazing video. She's got a bunch of amazing videos. She does a terrific blog. There's a lot of great information on there. We've linked all of that on the website for you, and I do hope you'll do some homework there. I don't want to read any further because then we'll be giving away her message, but I think you'll like it. It's something that we all think, but we're not allowed to say, and she's allowed to say it, so I'm going to let her run with it. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is a message that needs to get out desperately. But if we say it, we're racists and haters, so why don't you fire away with your thoughts? I really think you have a great message.
Well, my work as an advisor on the advisory board of the Clarion Project is that we expose radicalization and we give voice to moderate Muslims and progressive liberal Muslims, and this is why I am involved with them. And the message is that there is a global jihadist insurgency out there, that the terrorists have declared war on the West and its values, and we wonder how long it will take for the Western leadership to wake up and understand the depth of the problem. I am a practicing observant Muslim, but I understand that there is a virus of political Islam out there which needs to be tackled, and we can only do that if we can talk about it. And you just mentioned twice that if you talk about it, you will be labeled a racist, but our work is to encourage people to talk about it because there are ways of having this conversation without being offensive, without being racist, without being bigoted, and it's a conversation that must happen. It's a conversation that should have happened right after 9/11 because what we are faced with is a war of ideas. This is not a war of weapons. It's a war of ideas, and we need to have better ideas and alternate narrative, and that can only come about through open communication, through dialogue, through debates and discussions, and the freedom for people to ask difficult questions. So this is what I do 24/7. I'm a human rights advocate. I go to the United Nations Human Rights Council 3 times a year, essentially to be a thorn in the side of the OIC, which is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, a group of 57 Arab Muslim countries, whose only reason to be at the United Nations is to constantly criticize Israel and the United States and any aspect of the West. So according to them, all the human rights aberrations are taking place only in the West, while they are, you know, clean and white as newly washed cloth. So, it's very ironical. And when I, as a Muslim, speak out, especially as a Muslim woman, obviously they don't like it. And so the work that I do is challenging at many levels. But we have discovered, being involved in this, my organization is called Muslims Facing Tomorrow, and it's an organization to bring Muslims into the 21st century. And we critique all aspects of violence and terrorism and radicalization that are out there. And we realize that the frontline warriors in this battle for the soul of Islam, the faith, has to be Muslim.
So are you allowed to
That makes sense.
Are you allowed to speak on college campuses?
Well, I have. About 2 years ago, before this situation became so rife with political correctness, I traveled across 100 campuses with a documentary that was made by the Clarion Project called Honor Diaries. And this is an award-winning documentary which exposes the issues of honor-based violence, which is honor killings, forced and underage marriage, and female genital mutilation. And this was screened across about 100 campuses. And I totally understood the challenges that universities are now facing with this, stifling of free speech. But of course, in recent times, like in this past year or so, I haven't been able to do that because now universities are no longer bastions of free speech. There is very little you can say in a university campus, unless, of course, you're celebrating Israel Apartheid Week or you're, involved in the BDS movement, then, of course, you're welcome to lobby and rally and do whatever you want. But God forbid you should have a session about radical Islam. You'll be shut down, you'll be shut up, and you'll be booed out.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Welcome to our world.
You know, 2 years ago, I can see you traveling and speaking at colleges, but in today's environment, you're absolutely right. I can't see you getting within 100 feet of a campus without being shouted down or attacked. It's really sad. There is this free speech on college campuses really is kind of a thing of the past.
Which is where the ideas should be.
That's where they should be debated.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what college campuses are supposed to be. But, it's not sad. It's appalling. And it's appalling that we are allowing this to happen because, look, I am an immigrant. I came from a country where there wasn't free speech. So I value freedom of expression, the right of free speech, even if it means speaking out against something that is part of my own community or my own faith. But we should have the right of free speech, but it's not happening anymore. And this is something that really, really concerns me. And, as far as the issue of radicalization is concerned, I can at least still speak about it because I am a Muslim. But anybody else dare open their mouth, as you said, they'll be slapped with a label of Islamophobia and racism and bigotry. And that's not the way we will ever find a solution to the problem.
No,
because,
it's not.
You know, it's like a virus. It has to be identified. It has to be acknowledged. It has to be isolated. And only then we can find a cure for it.
So as a whole, how are you received in the Muslim community? Are you sort of an outcast, or is your message more popular than we might think?
Well, it depends on who you're speaking to. So, there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. They are very diverse. They come from varied mindsets. The progressive liberal Muslims who are fed up of this daily, waking up every week to see that there is another terrorist attack taking place. They are very welcoming of the message because, they are, for want of a better word, what we call moderate Muslims. They want to live their lives 9 to 5, be like anyone else, bring up their children, live in peace, and so they welcome the message. But of course, those who are Islamists, and allow me to differentiate between Islam as a faith like Judaism and Christianity and Islamism, which is a political ideology.
Thank you.
And
there is a big difference. Yeah.
It is a big difference, and it's a very important difference. It's a difference that people need to understand if they want to be part of this discussion and debate. Because, unfortunately, both extremes don't work. Lumping all Muslims under one banner of terrorism is not accurate and not right and doesn't work. And the other side, acting like there is nothing wrong and there is no problem, also doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have a balanced conversation with Muslims involved in it. And so in answer to your question, we started the Muslim Reform Movement about 2 years ago. And since then, it has grown. Our support has grown, not just from Muslims, but from non-Muslims as well, because in actual fact, it seems to be the only solution. And we always give the example of the Christian Reform, which, as you know, is celebrating 500 years this year. So, any reform, any change is slow, it's challenging, it's full of pushback, but it has to start somewhere. And we believe that we've sown the seeds of change and that this is where it's going to come from. It's going to come from the West, from North America. I am very hopeful and optimistic because here we have the freedoms and the safety to speak out, despite the backlash that we get.
Well, see, in your article, I thought it was interesting, and that was part of the piece I had put on the page, that you contend that it's crucial to criticize white supremacists like the KKK, as we've seen in the wake of Charlottesville, but as a society, Americans must also condemn Islamist supremacists.
And, yes, absolutely.
And it is a double standard that we don't do that.
Yes, well, you know, the
millions
of people can come out into the streets and rally against the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis and white supremacists, and that's good, because that is evil and it needs to be condemned. But similarly, in fact, more dangerous is the evil of Islamist supremacists, who not only want to promote their message, but they kill people in the name of promoting that message. And, you know, this is not just me saying it. All you have to do is look at the past year and see the number of terrorist attacks that took place. And unfortunately, most of them were done by Islamist terrorists. So this is a conversation that we have to have. It's an open and honest conversation, because unless we condemn similarly the Islamist supremacists, we are not being true to ourselves. And it's a hypocrisy, and it's double standards. And now we are faced with the regressive left. We are faced with white liberal guilt. We are faced with political correctness. So we are not really moving ahead at the pace that we should. We are in the 21st century. It's been so many years after 9/11. Yet we haven't been able to fight the war on terror.
So
why? Because we are not able to put policies into place.
Sure, we can't say anything.
No, we can't.
Well, I was curious. You probably, I'm guessing you get quite a bit of pushback from your own community, but I'm curious what you think of places like in, I know it happens elsewhere, but the picture in my head is in Paris, where they all break out their prayer rugs in the middle of the street and they shut down all the commerce and transport during periods of time during the day. Things like that.
That's ridiculous. That's a nuisance value. And they're just doing that to get attention. I mean, you know, prayer and worship is a very private matter. As I said, I'm a practicing Muslim. I pray 5 times a day, but I don't have to do it in the street.
You don't run out in the middle of the road, right?
Well, exactly. Exactly. And in fact, you know, the very, very core and authentic message of Islam tells us that your worship and your relationship to God should not be a show of public. It's a very private matter. How we behave in the public actually tells people who we are. I mean, you know, if you're an American, you should be a loyal citizen to the country. We must observe and respect the Universal Charter of Human Rights. It's how we behave with each other. But this unnecessary show of piety is something that is not accepted by Islam, and it's something that I'm embarrassed about.
Well, I don't think it actually has anything to do with their faith. I think it has everything to do with putting it in everybody's face.
Ideology.
It's like, I dare you to come out and say anything, because then you're affecting my religion, which is obviously
exactly. And they're not real. So cocky about this because you know, the West is tongue-tied when they see something that is being done in the name of a faith, or what they perceive to be done in the name of the faith, because there's a lot of ignorance out there. You know, the faith is not telling us to go out and kill people. This is an ideology. It's an evil ideology. And, you know, I look upon Islamism, the political ideology, like fascism and Marxism, because when that was rampant in the world, everybody, the world globally, got together to condemn it and speak out against it. But now it's Islamism, and because it is somehow connected to a faith, people are afraid to speak out. So therefore, it becomes even more important for Muslims to stand up and speak out. We must clean up the garbage in our own community. We must look at what is happening to our faith and take back the spirituality of that faith. And that is what we are trying to do. You know, as hard as it is, as you asked me, if there's pushback from my own community, of course there is, because they look upon me as some sort of a traitor to the faith. But
the point is
that it's embedded in the faith to say that we must condemn that which is evil and promote that which is good. So I don't believe that I'm doing anything that is outside the circle of my faith. In fact, the change has to come from within the faith. The reform has to come from within the faith. And therefore, we need to empower the silent majority of Muslims who don't want to have anything to do with any of this, because you know, it's not pleasant. It's something that is challenging, and they don't want to get involved, but they, by their silence, to me, they are part of the problem. We need as many voices as we can.
Yeah, unfortunately, the voice we hear are the Islamists, supremacists. That's what we hear. How do you fight back? I mean, obviously, they've declared this jihad against the West, and we have all these homegrown or self-proclaimed jihadists here committing these crimes in our country. And they tout that, you know, that's what's written in the Quran. This is how I'm supposed to act.
Well, and that's what they're supposedly taught at their mosque and everything.
Yeah, and how do you change that from the mosque level where they're being taught this ideology? How do you fight that?
Well, the thing is that it's not an easy process, and it's not an overnight process, but it can be done. It has to be done at two levels. The first level is within the community. You know, we have to stand up to these certain mosques and Islamic institutions from where the messages of hate are coming. You know, first of all, everyone has to understand that terrorism is only the end result of radicalization. The root cause is the teaching of hate and the radicalization, and someone is doing it. There's no such thing as a lone wolf. Someone is teaching these people that to hate and to kill. We have to find out where those messages are coming from.
Well, don't you?
And we have to. Yes, go ahead.
Don't you know where it's coming from? I mean, there's mosques out
well,
there
to
that
some
they've
level,
identified.
Yes, we do. Uh-huh. To some level, we do. But it's also the education at home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what parents are teaching their children.
Right.
And I always say this is where we need to empower women, because they are the mothers who will teach their child, their son, either to become a suicide bomber or to become a democratic citizen of the country he's living in.
Well, sure. that was my big question is how does, I mean, we've got to take a really quick break. But when we come back, I really want to know, where does that come from that a mom would, I mean, dads too, but okay, just moms. How does a mom raise a child to strap on a bomb and go die and think that that's a good thing? I don't even understand that. And how long does it take to convince someone of that in your opinion and what you've seen? We'd be real curious to have some insight on that, because that is a big mystery right there. We're going to be right back. We're here at We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Bob, the love train. You never know where that one's going to pop up. Classic. Oh, my goodness. So we are here with Rahil Raza. She's the Clarion Project Advisory Board member and a founding member of the Muslim Reformer Movement. She's an international human rights activist, and she's talking about the threat posed by Islamist supremacy, which is really hard to say, by the way. It does not roll right off your tongue.
No, it doesn't.
Every time I look at it, I'm like, yeah, you're like, I got it, I can't say it. Well, so, okay, talk to us about these moms. Who?
Well, these, Yeah.
How do you get into a space in your head where you think it's okay to sacrifice your kids?
Well, I think you have to understand that a large part of the Muslim world is third world countries,
right,
where their illiteracy and ignorance and lack of education are a main problem, especially for the women. So these women are not independent thinkers. These women don't have individual thought. They have been told and brainwashed in their own lives to believe that this is what is the right thing, and this is what they're doing because this has been embedded into them. And this is unfortunately one of the biggest problems that we have faced, the ignorance, the lack of education, not only secular education, but information and education about our own faith.
Sure.
So, you know, this is, these are ideological mullahs who say whatever they want. I mean, they are promoting an ideology. And, of course, this ideology has been promoted on the backs of billions of petrodollars through the oil sands of Saudi Arabia into third world countries, and where they even when they can, they bring curriculum that is so against the core beliefs of the faith that it's mind-boggling. But they've been doing this for 40 years now. I mean, I have two sons. They fit the perfect profile of the so-called Muslim terrorists. They are young, they are Muslim, they are brown and bearded. But I'm the one who's educated them. And they have a mind of their own. They're, you know, we encourage individual thinking, individual thought, and, enlightenment, vision. This is what is needed in the Muslim world desperately.
Well, and if you have a future, you can see. I mean, if you plan for a future, I think about, you know, when I was a kid, you know, my mom was always talking about later, right? When you get to high school, you're, yeah, you know, we're going to do this. When you get to college, you're going to do this. Yeah. When you have your own kids. Mm-hmm. And my guess is
very, very important what we have to do. So in our organization, we have a mandate of the three E's. We say we have to expose the problem, we have to educate the masses, and then we have to empower them for change from within. We are at the very first level of even trying to expose the problem,
sure,
and
sure,
it's no help when you have political correctness stifling open conversation.
Yeah, what about all the dopey white people that are in the midst of this whole thing? Because they're the ones fueling it, really. You've got this whole batch of people that they do most of the silencing. It really isn't the Muslim community. I think it's seems to be mostly the other guys, the non-Muslim community.
It's causing a lot of harm because, let's face it, there is a problem within the Muslim world which we want to deal with. But there's also a problem with the leadership of the Western world that has been so wishy-washy in allowing much of this to happen. And I'll give you an example of the United Kingdom. I'm going there next week. I've been invited to come and speak about Sharia councils that have existed. There are 85 Sharia councils operating in the United Kingdom under the blessing of the government, by the way. Now, in an afterthought, they are finding that, oops, Muslim women have come to them and said, what have you done to us? It's causing havoc in our lives, and now they want to try to change that. So the questioning should be done to the leadership of the Western world as well. Were they asleep at the wheel when they were letting Islamists come in and, you know, just do what they wanted to, even when the law enforcement agencies knew that they were criminals and they were planning and plotting? In the aftermath of the London Bridge attacks, the vehicular attacks in London, law enforcement actually said that they knew some of these perpetrators. They knew that they existed. Well, if they did, then why didn't they lock them up?
Yeah.
So, you know, these are valid questions that we need to ask because, let's face it, the Muslim community alone can't fight this. We need the help of civil society, government, leadership, non-Muslims, everybody, to come together and work from one platform. And that platform is that this is a war of ideas. We have to have better ideas, a better narrative, policies that are different from the policies that were in place even 25 years ago, because it's a different world. A post 9/11 world is a very different world.
Do you find Sharia law getting a foothold here in the United States, and how dangerous is that?
Well, I don't see it happen, but yes, there are Islamists who would like to see Sharia law implemented. And I'm a Canadian. I live in the province of Ontario in Canada, And about 5 years ago, there was a move to have Sharia law here, and we fought long and hard for 1 year. And finally, that piece of law that allowed arbitration was actually thrown out. But if given an opportunity, there are people in the West, in America, who would like to have Sharia law. For as far as I'm concerned, there should be only one law for all. If we come to the West by choice, then we should follow the law of the land. And this, by the way, which many people don't know, is an Islamic mandate. Follow the law of the land where you live unless it forces you to go against your faith, which, of course, it doesn't. So there's absolutely no need for a parallel set of laws because all it does is oppress women. These are man-made laws. They have not been vetted. They were frozen in the 9th and 10th centuries. So obviously they are not applicable in the 21st century. So these are things that are not discussed openly. It's all happening under the table, and it's very, our Western leaders just think, okay, let's look the other way. You know, it's their culture. They want to do it, so let's allow them. Well, it comes to bite you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just creates a nightmare. So you have, I know that they were doing some type of surveillance, and they were sending, you know, I don't know, spies, I guess, for lack of a better word. But they're sending people in to keep track of what was going on in these different mosques in places like New York City, for instance. And that's all been deemed to be inappropriate. You're not allowed to go see what everybody's up to and monitor that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that harsh times call for harsh measures. In France and Germany, they now have a law that the sermon in the mosque has to be in the language of the country. And they're also checking the sermons to see that there's no hate messaging there. And if they find that there is hate messaging, they will close that mosque.
And where is this?
In France and in Germany.
Oh, they finally kind of got the... They finally got some religion, as they say.
So they're doing that. Now, you know, I understand the issue of freedoms and rights and free speech, but, you know, if we know that there are messages of hate and there is hate mongering coming from certain mosques, which of course there is not all, but from some, then perhaps surveillance is necessary. I mean, this is the only measure.
But aren't we really, don't we have to depend on the members of the mosque to kind of self-report when that, I mean, if they go to that mosque that teaches hate, I think they're part of the problem, but there's got to be people that attend those mosques that don't agree with that. And don't we have to kind of depend on them to step forward and say, hey, this is going on. What can we do about it?
But so here's the thing. It's only about 20% of the Muslim community that is mosque attending. What happens is that very, very often that they just stop going to that mosque. You know, they don't take action. They don't stand up in the middle of the sermon and say, hey, Imam, what you're saying is wrong, because they somehow are intimidated. Mm-hmm. They think, that this is a person that they can't speak out against. And this is why the problem has become so acute. If the Muslim community had taken, if the Muslim communities, I should say, had taken this responsibility and done the self-monitoring, I guess we wouldn't be where we are. And yes, I agree with you. They should be the first line of defense. They should be the ones who should speak out against any kind of hate messaging, against any kind of divisive messaging, because this is something when children hear, when young people hear, then they sort of absorb this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only way that you can hurt another person is if they are dehumanized to you, and if this is happening week after week and you're being told that they are not the same as you and their values are not the same as yours. But the places where the messaging is coming from, they've also become very clever, and sometimes the messaging is very subtle. They're not telling their congregation to go out and kill people, but they're still talking about differences. There's still there's a lot of anti-Semitism. And this is something we should be cognizant of.
Sure. And, you know, it's no different than any other church. If you attend a sermon and you don't like what's being said, or you feel that, you know, what's being said is a hate message, I think you have a responsibility. And I think in most cases, word gets out pretty fast, and attendance does go down, and the word in the community gets out that that particular church or whatever it is teaching a negative message. Is that the case with the mosques, though? Because if what you're saying, if only 20% of the people, 20% of Muslims go or participate at the mosque, does that mean that the ones that do participate at the mosques are the ones we have to watch out for?
Well, not all of them, but largely, yes, because they are influenced by the messaging. And the messaging is coming either from the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood or from Khomeinism in case of the Shia Muslims or from the Salafi Wahhabi ideology. Now, about 5 years ago, there was an article in the Washington Post that said that almost 80% of American mosques were now infiltrated with Wahhabi Saudi money. And obviously, money comes with an agenda.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if that money is being pumped into the mosques, and the messaging is also coming from there. The sermons are also coming from there, and very often they will place in place of a very visionary moderate imam, they will put one of their own Saudi Salafi imams, and then the messaging changes. And I've seen that happen in mosques. So, yes, it is not being monitored by the communities themselves. So we have a problem. We have a serious issue.
So do we put a moratorium on building mosques? I mean, is that out of the question?
When you talk about religious freedoms, I think it could probably be unconstitutional.
Right, right.
Sure.
It is supposed to be a place of worship. Now, if it was, it would be benign and wonderful if that's all it was, as some mosques are. As I said, not all mosques are giving messages of hate, but the problem is that this influence of the Wahhabis is so big and there is so much money involved. You know, someone said track the money. If you track the money, where it's coming from, and by the way, it's coming into American universities as well in very large amounts. So if you track the money, then you understand that these subversive agendas are coming on the backs of millions of petrodollars.
Sure. How?
So, many different levels. Now, in July, I was invited to give testimony to the United States Congress. Clarion Project had arranged for this. And I went and spoke in the U.S. Congress to the Committee on Homegrown Terrorism. And I made 4 recommendations to them. And one of the recommendations was to stop the flow of money coming in from terror-producing countries into our universities and academic institutions. So there is a very strong connection to the financing.
Sure.
Interesting. And what did they say? I mean, was there any... they just listen?
It was well received, I have to say. They asked very good questions. Whether or not they've taken any action against it, I don't know. I'm just one person, an activist, and a grandmother who's concerned about the future of the next generations. I don't know how much authority they give what I have to say. But certainly, we have been working in this field for over 25 years now. So I would say that I think we have an idea of what we are talking about. But, we can only give advice. We can only expose the problem. The final policies and the change has to come from the top down.
Sure.
So what I'm saying is that the work has to be done at both levels, from the activists and the grassroots people who are working in human rights and who are trying to bring about change, and those at the top level who make the decisions.
And we have to stop knuckling under to allow these guys to get away with this stuff incrementally, the praying in the middle of the street and shutting down, the roads. I mean, that's all incremental stuff to manipulate society, just piece by piece.
Yes, that's civil disturbance, and it should be stopped under the issue of civil disturbance. But, of course, any time there is a faith involved, people are reticent.
Hands off.
Europe is a very, very good example of a bad situation. We need to look at Europe and say we don't want this to happen here. We have a window of opportunity where we can bring about change. And I believe that, there are Muslim Americans who are loyal to the country who want to see this change, and they should be empowered. They should be brought into the discussion and debate. And together with them, we need to bring about this change.
How can we be more successful getting this message out to college campuses and allowing the message to be heard?
Well, if the college campuses allow people to come in and speak, I think we need to have open dialogue and discussion.
Sure.
This is, if the discussion is squashed. If there is no debate and discussion about the issue, it just goes underground. And then it sort of, you know, bursts open in very unpleasant ways. And we've seen the result of that when people are stifled from asking pertinent questions. You know, as far as I'm concerned, every citizen has a right to question the safety and security of his country and a right to question what is happening with terrorism and radicalization. None of these questions should be off the record. In fact, in our work, we encourage this questioning. And I believe we need to continue to leave the doors of communication open and have many more of these conversations like you and I are having in the civil square, in the universities, in the educational institutions, because when I traveled across the campuses, there was a hunger by the students who are totally ignorant about what's happening because they are being spoon-fed all sorts of propaganda and conspiracy theories.
Sure.
They need to be able to speak to people who are in the trenches, so to speak, and ask them all the questions they have on their mind.
Well, I'm curious, in your lifetime, you said you're a grandmother. I think actually everybody here is a grandparent, so this is like the old people's today.
Old people's forum here.
So you're in old people land. How have you seen it change in, I don't know when you moved to a Western country, but how have you seen this change in your lifetime?
Well, I came 30 years ago, and I've seen it change incredibly. You know, I came with my family to embrace the values of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, gender equality. That's very important to me because, you know, I come from a Muslim country. I was born and brought up in Pakistan, and in my childhood, women were supposed to be seen and not heard. So I understand the values of freedom, individual thought, and as I said, all the freedoms and embracing a liberal democracy. And I've seen things go downhill, especially after 9/11. You know, as I said, the rise of the regressive left, this political correctness, this stifling of free speech, it really is of great concern to me because this is what I left behind. And the rise of Islamist terrorism and the freedom with which they move around. I mean, these people know that they can get away with so much because of political correctness of the mainstream who are not willing to acknowledge that there is a problem.
Well, when you were living in Pakistan, did these things happen in Pakistan and we just didn't know about it until it came here?
Well, I grew up in a very different Pakistan. So this rise of this Islamist ideology is about 40 years old. I can probably pin it down to the time that I left Pakistan.
Okay.
When I was growing up in Pakistan, it was a different Islam. It was a different Pakistan. Very pluralistic. Religion was not puffed down our throat. You know, we had culture, we had art and music. Now these things are considered to be sinful by the Wahhabis. So we saw this wave of this Wahhabi Salafi ideology coming from Saudi Arabia, and that was when we realized, my husband and I, that we had to move out because we are activists, and you know, we couldn't live under this kind of rigidity, the orthodoxy that was coming in. And so it was, I feel very sad to say, it was a very different country at that time because it was not engulfed by the oil money. And as I said, it's all about the money, the subversive agendas. And then, of course, after 9/11, things changed even more. Instead of facing this problem head on, you know, the Western leadership went into all sorts of political maneuverings. And, of course, oil prices have had a lot, a role to play in this as well.
Mm-hmm.
So many leaders have looked the other way at human rights aberrations. I mean, the human rights.
Uh-oh. That sounded bad. She got cut off at the pass. Ooh, let's take a quick break while we call her back.
All right.
She was going to have to leave early. This is a great way to keep her hostage till
the top of the hour,
huh? You
can't just cut off like that.
But we can say that now because she's not listening.
Yeah, you can't just hang up.
She is super interesting. You are listening to We the People Radio. Our guest has been Rahil Raza. She is an international speaker and human rights activist with the Clarion Project. We'll be back. We're going to call her and see if we can catch her again. Stick with us.
Why do I feel this way? Promise of me.
More good songs. Thanks, Bob.
Sowing the seeds of love.
Sowing the seeds of love. So our guest has vanished into the ether from which she came. And so we're sorry about that.
We have a theory she may have run out of cell phone juice.
Yeah, either that or battery. Because she had a pretty good connection. She might
and
have
then
been
it just abruptly went away.
And who knows what's going on in Canada. Maybe they're having a storm or something. But she had told us, just full disclosure, she suddenly told us at the beginning of the show she could only be on for a half hour. So
we
manipulated the brakes.
Manipulated
so we
a little bit.
We
could keep her
on
a little longer.
He kept her on for 45 minutes.
I find it very interesting what she was saying about the extremists taking over her religion.
Yeah.
You know,
she said it was never like that as a kid. And, you know, we've heard that over and over and over. We heard that with Fred and Ross, the mm-hmm. Iranians from the American Organization of Iranian States. Those guys, they've said that over and over. Their country was never like that. You
right.
look at pictures of Iran back in the 70s. And they were all, it looked Western.
It looked very Western. It looked like a regular city, you know. They dressed like everybody else. And it's interesting how this jihad movement has really crippled the Middle East and all these big cities.
Well, and the
just
bad
fallen.
Part is a lot of it, the people that are rolling over for it, are the people here.
Right.
You know, are Westernized people because they don't understand or don't want to understand the danger. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, well, that's just not happening.
Yeah.
Well, saying it's not happening isn't good enough.
Well, it's a huge religion, and I'm sorry we lost her because I wanted to ask her what
about
she
a million
thought.
Other things.
Oh yeah, but you know, her community or her circle of influence doesn't believe in this, and I was curious to know as a whole of the Muslim faith. She said it was a billion or whatever. How many of those
yeah.
people actually are going for this?
Well,
and
she
how
said
many
only
them...
20% even go to mosque. That was new
right,
for me.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Which begs to the question, the ones that do go to the mosque, are
yeah.
they the ones we got to watch out for?
Yeah, who's actually drinking the Kool-Aid? Well, mm-hmm. her article that we have linked for you on the webpage, entitled New York Attack, she says, once again, evil has struck New York City. Our thoughts and prayers are with the families of the victims. But she says, facts are quite straightforward, and this is her list. It's cowardly. It will happen again. This is part of the war on the West declared by jihadists. There are no lone wolves.
And we've heard that from lots of people.
Wanted to ask her some more about that. This was done in the name of jihad. Politicians will deflect. My co-religionists will go on the defensive. The victimhood ideology will swing into action. And, oh, my gosh, we see that every time. Is there a solution? She says yes, but is anyone listening? No. There's a symbolic problem which is not being addressed head on. What actions being taken against Islamic fighters coming home to Western countries? That's a $64,000 mm-hmm. question. What action is being taken to go to the root of radicalization and the teaching of hate? When converts are involved, who's converting them? And when radicalization is going on, are we peeping into the pulpit?
Right.
Time to
See,
end the
that's
terror.
That's the big rub. You know, the freedom of religion keeps us from infiltrating these mosques, and yet we know that's where this message of hate is being taught, is in these mosques.
And it's a very small percentage of people who consider themselves to be Muslims.
Right.
Which is interesting. And I was curious about the prayer rug thing in the middle of the road in Paris. And
well, she kinda...
I think that happens other places too. But every time I see that, I'm like, how are you guys falling for this, that this is a religion thing? This mm-hmm. is obviously civil disobedience. And just designed to force them to kowtow to them, pretending it's a religious thing. Because in reality, I guess you can't put your prayer rug someplace that's dirty.
Right.
I read that and I thought,
you're
not allowed to wear your shoes in the mosque. So they're going to throw their prayer rugs down on the city street. I have noticed in some...
Ew.
Yeah, ew.
Ew.
Yeah, you can't even eat gum or something if it falls on the. Well,
I also found it interesting
seconds.
That she referred to them as Islamists, and you know that they're the ones you got to watch out for.
But how do you know?
How do you know?
Like she said, she's got two sons that totally fit the profile in their 20s, beards, Muslims.
But she raised them, and they don't believe that.
Right?
They don't believe.
And that's a really important distinction, but that makes it a million times harder. You know, pretend we're law enforcement, right? It's like, well, how did that help us?
Yeah. We need to get Bruce back on.
Give us the 411. Well, we're going to have Claire back on the 10th. So let me look at that. We were also, since we're killing a minute here, I just thought I'd let our listeners know kind of what our demographic looks like because it's so interesting. And this is the demographic on the website. So these are the folks that are listening to the archive after the fact, not listening on the actual radio here in Redding, California on Sunday afternoon. So
this is the WeThePeopleRadio.us website.
Correct.
Okay. And so that doesn't even count who might also be
that's true,
listening
on the KCNR.
On KCNR's website.
That's true. So these are only the stats that I can get from just our site. So about 36% comes from the United States of America. This is in the last 30 days. So, of course, it can change over time, but it's been pretty consistent. So 36% of our listeners are actually in the U.S. We have 11.5% who are in the Ukraine. And the Ukraine...
God bless them.
God bless the Ukrainians.
Yep.
Hey, all you Ukrainians out there, you should be sending us emails and letting us know what kind of topics you want to hear.
Let's know what
since
Putin's
you are,
up to.
They're the largest out of the U.S. block of people who listen are the Ukrainians. Next comes France, Russia, China, Germany, the U.K., Ireland, and Canada.
Does that make us colluding with
oh,
the
yeah,
Russians?
Oh, yeah, totally.
I'm sure
we're
it does.
We're colluding, aren't we?
And what is it? Not the Moldovians, because Moldova's down there, but what are they called?
The Macedonians.
Macedonians, yeah. We don't have them. We did have them 1 month. But
well, they're all a bunch of hackers. That's Hillary. They'll take over your
genius
site.
Hackers.
That's right.
So three cheers to the Ukrainians, and thanks for joining
bunch
us.
Bunch of meerkats down there.
I hope you guys had a fun time with the show. Between the unions and the Islamists, today was action-packed. We're doing something fun next week. I forgot what it is, but I know it was fun. And hold on, I'm looking really fast. Ooh, some self-defense stuff with Brad Steiner. And then we have Brad Grenier on about the opioid crisis. They actually have a thing that can solve it. So check us out online, WeThePeopleRadio.us.
That's right. The Europeans can hack that website anytime.
Absolutely.
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
There you are.
And go Ukraine.
For those of you listening over the airwaves, this is KCNR Shasta Redding.